This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to posterior shoulder instability and dislocation, as well as extremity flap reconstruction, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with posterior shoulder instability and dislocation. And the first question reads, a football lineman who sustained a traumatic injury while blocking during a game now reports that his shoulder is slipping while pass blocking. Examination reveals no apprehension in abduction and external rotation. However, he reports pain with posterior translation of the shoulder. He has full strength in external rotation, internal rotation, and supraspinatus testing. What is the pathology most likely responsible for his symptoms? And the choices are 1. Anterior glenoid rim fracture tear, 2. Anterior inferior labral tear, 3. Posterior labral tear, 4. Total capsular laxity, and 5. Osteochondral defect of the humeral head. Traumatic posterior instability is a common finding in football players, especially in the blocking positions as well as in the defensive linemen and linebackers. A traumatic blow to the outstretched arm results in posterior glenohumeral forces. Labral detachment at the glenoid rim is common. Patients report slipping or pain with posteriorly directed pressure. Rarely do these patients have true dislocations that require reduction. However, recurrent episodes of subluxation or pain are not uncommon. Posterior repair has been shown to be successful in the treatment of traumatic instability. So the correct answer to this question is 3, posterior labral tear. Moving on to the next question. What is the primary sign/symptom with unidirectional posterior instability of the shoulder? And the choices are 1, instability, 2, dead arm symptoms, 3, locking or catching, 4, decreased range of motion, or 5, pain. So posterior labral tears and pathology are usually associated with recurrent chronic injury to the shoulder. Situations such as blocking in football load the humeral head posteriorly and may predispose to posterior labral injury. Unlike anterior and superior labral pathology, symptoms of posterior labral tears are often vague, though pain with activity is most common. Instability is usually associated with anterior labral pathology. Dead arm symptoms are associated with anterior and superior pathology, especially in throwers. Mechanical locking and catching are less common for any labral pathology. Range of motion with posterior labral pathology is usually unaffected. Moving on to the next question, which of the following is helpful on physical examination to diagnose a fixed posterior shoulder dislocation? And the choices are 1, apprehension test, 2, Job relocation test, 3, sulcus sign, 4, jerk test, and 5, lack of external rotation. So the apprehension sign and Job relocation test are helpful for the diagnosis of anterior shoulder instability. The sulcus sign provides information on the status of the rotator interval. The jerk test is helpful for the diagnosis of posterior instability, but a fixed posterior shoulder dislocation is associated with loss of external rotation. Since an AP radiograph may miss this diagnosis, an axillary view should be obtained on patients with a shoulder injury. But the correct answer to this question asking which physical exam maneuver is most helpful to diagnose a fixed posterior shoulder dislocation, the answer is 5, lack of external rotation. Moving on to the next question. In recurrent posterior shoulder instability, what is the recommended approach to the posterior capsule? And the choices are 1, a teres minor splitting approach, 2, an infraspinatus splitting approach, 3, between the infraspinatus and teres minor, 4, between the supraspinatus and infraspinatus, and 5, in the rotator interval. So using an infraspinatus splitting incision allows for excellent exposure of the posterior capsule and minimizes the risk of injury to the axillary nerve, which lies inferior to the teres minor in the quadrilateral space. So the correct answer to this question is 2, an infraspinatus splitting approach is the recommended approach to the posterior capsule in recurrent posterior shoulder instability. Moving on to the next question. An acute posterior shoulder dislocation should be suspected in a patient with pain and the shoulder locked in what position? And the choices are 1, internal rotation, 2, external rotation, 3, forward elevation, 4, abduction, and 5, retraction. So patients with posterior shoulder dislocations are often overlooked. They present with the shoulder locked in internal rotation and adduction and lack external rotation. Orthogonal radiographs, that is an AP and an axillary lateral, are absolutely necessary for proper diagnosis. Posterior dislocation patients often have a reverse Bankart and a reverse Hill-Sachs lesion. Ivkovich et al. Reported a case of bilateral posterior dislocations successfully treated with hemiarthroplasty and osteochondral allograft. Longo et al. Performed a systematic review of 31 randomized controlled trials and concluded primary surgery is favorable in young adults engaged in highly demanding sports or job activities. However, there is lack of evidence to determine whether surgical or non-surgical treatment is better for other categories of injury. Paul et al. Found 9 Level 4 articles in the evidence-based literature regarding posterior shoulder dislocation management. The size of the humeral head impression fracture is key for decision-making. Non-operative treatment can confer satisfactory results for older, lower-demand patients or those with unstable epilepsy. However, surgical treatment is recommended to achieve good functional results in other patient populations. But the correct answer to this question, asking about an acute posterior shoulder dislocation and what position the shoulder would be locked in, the answer is 1, internal rotation. Moving on to the next question. A football player subluxates his shoulder while blocking with his arm forward flexed and internally rotated. The jerk test is positive. What is his most likely pathology? And the choices are 1, a Bankart lesion, 2, a Kim lesion, 3, a Hill-Sachs lesion, 4, glenohumeral internal rotation deficit, and 5, acromioclavicular separation. So this football player likely suffered a posterior inferior labral tear, also known as a Kim lesion, or a reverse Bankart lesion. So the correct answer to this question is 2, a Kim lesion. The jerk test is where a posterior force is applied along the axis of the humerus with the arm in forward flexion and internal rotation. This will cause the humeral head to subluxate posteriorly out of the glenoid socket. As the arm is brought into extension, a clunk will be felt as the humerus reduces into the glenoid cavity. A Hill-Sachs lesion is a bony humeral impaction lesion from an anterior dislocation. A glenohumeral internal rotation deficit, or GERD, is found in throwers who have a tight posterior inferior capsule and lack internal rotation. An acromioclavicular separation has pain over the AC joint and may have a positive piano key sign when the clavicle pops up with arm depression. Moving on to the next question, which of the following patients may benefit from a lesser tuberosity transfer, otherwise known as a modified McLaughlin procedure? And the choices are 1, a kidney transplant recipient with AVN of the humeral head, 2, a patient with severe rheumatoid arthritis, 3, a young man with a locked posterior dislocation following an electric shock injury at work, 4, a patient with a history of previous shoulder surgery that now has a subscapularis insufficiency, and 5, a patient with a large Hill-Sachs defect following an anterior shoulder dislocation. So forceful posterior glenohumeral dislocations, such as those resulting from seizures or electric shock, may sustain a large reverse Hill-Sachs defect, resulting in persistent instability in internal rotation or a locked posterior dislocation. These patients may benefit from having the lesser tuberosity, along with the subscapularis, advanced into the bony defect on the anterior humeral head, otherwise known as the modified McLaughlin procedure. The original description by McLaughlin involved transferring the subscapularis tendon into the defect and was later modified and popularized by Neer, who recommended transferring the lesser tuberosity with the subscapularis. Finkelstein et al. Reported good functional results using this procedure acutely in 7 patients who were unstable in internal rotation and had an anteromedial impaction fracture occupying 25-40% of the articular surface. Hawkins et al. Described various treatments for locked posterior dislocations. All 4 of their patients with a lesser tuberosity transfer did well, and they suggest using it when close reduction fails for smaller defects and for moderate defects with head involvement of 20-45%. But the correct answer to this question asking about what patient would benefit from a lesser tuberosity transfer or a modified McLaughlin procedure is answer choice 3, a young man with a locked posterior dislocation following an electric shock injury at work. And the final question for this topic, posterior glenohumeral dislocations are as common as anterior dislocations in which of the following patient groups? And the choices are 1, football players, 2, Marfan syndrome patients, 3, renal failure patients, 4, epilepsy patients, and 5, women. So Millett et al. And Robinson et al. Provide review articles on posterior shoulder dislocations, which are rare clinical entities that occur during seizures and electrocution due to tetanic muscle contraction or as a result of high-energy trauma. Robinson et al. Noted that poor prognostic factors associated with posterior shoulder dislocation include late diagnosis, large bony defects of the humeral head, associated proximal humerus fractures, and the need for arthroplasty. In Gerber's series, posterior dislocations occurred with equal frequency to anterior in a cohort of epilepsy patients. So the correct answer to this question is 4, epilepsy patients. And moving on to the next topic of extremity flap reconstruction, the first question reads, which of the following arteries is the pedicle supplied to the lateral arm flap? And the choices are 1, radial recurrent, 2, profunda brachii, 3, interosseous recurrent, 4, anterior radial collateral, and 5, posterior radial collateral. So the posterior radial collateral artery provides the vascular supply to the lateral arm flap. The radial collateral artery travels with the radial nerve in the spiral groove until both penetrate the lateral intermuscular septum. It then divides into the anterior and posterior radial collateral arteries. The posterior branch passes posterior to the lateral intermuscular septum. But the correct answer to this question is 5. The posterior radial collateral is the pedicle supply to the lateral arm flap. Moving on to the next question, what is the most efficient pressure for use with negative pressure wound therapy? And the choices are 1, 25 millimeters of mercury, 2, 75 millimeters of mercury, 3, 125 millimeters of mercury, 4, 300 millimeters of mercury, and 5, 500 millimeters of mercury. So in animal and clinical studies, a range of pressures between 50 millimeters of mercury to 500 millimeters of mercury were tested. The most efficient pressure was 125 millimeters of mercury, resulting in a 4-fold increase in blood flow, 63% increase in granulation tissue with continuous pressure, and 103% increase in granulation tissue with intermittent pressure. When 125 millimeters of mercury pressures were compared with either those less than 50 or those greater than 250, there was a decrease in granulation tissue in swine models. So the correct answer to this question is 3, 125 millimeters of mercury. Moving on to the next question, a 32-year-old male sustains a type 3B open proximal third tibia fracture. 4 days after intramedullary nailing of the tibia, the wound is clean and ready for coverage with a medial gastrocnemius rotational flap. What is the dominant arterial blood supply to this flap? And the choices are 1, superior and inferior genicular arteries, 2, anterior tibial artery, 3, posterior tibial artery, 4, sural artery, and 5, the saphenous artery. So the dominant arterial blood supply to a medial gastrocnemius muscle flap is the sural artery. Rotational gastrocnemius flaps are useful for coverage of the proximal third of the tibia and some wounds/defects about the knee. Medial and lateral gastrocnemius arterial supply is from the medial and lateral sural arteries respectively. Coverage of the middle third of the tibia requires use of a rotational soleus muscle flap supplied by the peroneal artery proximally and the posterior tibial artery distally. Coverage of the distal third of the tibia requires a free muscle flap transfer based on a specific vascular pedicle. So the correct answer to this question asking what is the dominant arterial blood supply to a medial gastrocnemius rotational flap, the answer is 4, sural artery. And the final question for this review session, which is basically just asking the previous question in a different way, the sural artery provides the vascular supply to which musculocutaneous flap? And if you were paying attention to the last question, you should know the answer without hearing the choices, but the choices are 1, soleus, 2, gastrocnemius, 3, latissimus dorsi, 4, tibialis anterior, and 5, peroneus longus. So the sural artery supplies both heads of the gastrocnemius and is the pedicle for rotational flaps. 85% of the time, there is a single vascular source. So the correct answer to this question is 2, the sural artery provides the vascular supply to the gastrocnemius. That's all for this review session about posterior shoulder instability and dislocation, as well as extremity flap reconstruction. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.